From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. How is tomorrow the last day of January? Time, it's not what it used to be, but there are plenty of things to look forward to, even if we can't leave our houses. Like in before times, you'd actually have to go out to dinner and a show, but now, just leave those sweatpants on. You can watch a one-man play while you learn to make chicken curry from the comfort of your very own home. One of our favorite segments over the last couple of years has been my conversation with home chef and screenwriter Sri Rao. In his book, Bollywood Kitchen, he tells the story of his family immigrating to suburban Pennsylvania, their assimilation, and the role that Bollywood films played in his life, tying him back to home. A new stage version of the book is part of the Geffen Stayhouse series, and you can cook along with Sri as he weaves his story around chicken curry and basmati rice. Hi.
Hi, how are you? It's so good to talk to you again.
I am so thrilled that you're doing this. Your book for me was such a randomly strange delight, and I can't tell you how often I open it up.
Oh, I love to hear that. I love randomly strange delights.
Yeah, and I had already been watching so much Indian film and television, but that kind of like superpowered me into it. I just watched so much. Sometimes
I feel like... Oh, and they're fun, right?
Oh, they're so much fun. And it's such a huge industry. There's an endless supply of things to watch.
Yeah, it's the largest film industry in the world. They sell like twice as many tickets around the world than we do in Hollywood.
Really incredible. So you're in New York City, where theater in normal times is king. And you say that there are two questions that you're asked most often at cocktail parties.
That's right. I have been to countless parties and get-togethers where I continually get asked the same two questions. The first is, can you give me one of your mom's home-cooked Indian recipes? And the second is, what the hell is Bollywood? And can you recommend a movie that I should watch if I've never seen one before? And those two questions put together are the genesis of my book. You know, I finally, after giving out so many recipes and making so many recommendations for films, I finally just decided to put all the information in a book. And now I can tell them to buy the book when I get those questions.
And so how did the theater piece come about?
It's interesting. Probably the last time that we spoke was when I was on my book tour. And that's how this whole theater piece started. Because when the book came out, I went on this tour across the country. It was amazing for 3 weeks. And I went to, I think, 13 different cities. And in each city, we had a different, really special and creative event. Because my cookbook is not a traditional cookbook, because it's a dinner and a movie concept, the events for my book tour were also equally unique. So, for example, we would be in a museum and I'd be giving a talk about Bollywood. And then we'd have Bollywood dancers and then a cocktail reception afterwards. Or I was at CIA and giving a cooking demonstration, but then we were showing clips of Bollywood movies on the screens, and then we did a Bollywood dance class after. So lots of really interesting combinations of food and music and dancing all together. And then when I got back to New York, I live right in the heart of the theater district. So the question came up, well, can't we turn that experience into a theatrical event? And that's how it all began.
So if people get tickets to this show, what can they expect?
So it's a really cool evening, especially tailored for these times that we are in. You know, I don't know about you, but I haven't had anyone over to my house in the past year. So what we've designed is an evening for us all to get together and break bread together. So if you get a ticket, what happens is that I invite you into my home. It's live and interactive. I invite you into my apartment in Manhattan, where we will cook dinner together. And I'll send you a box box of all the spices that you need to cook along with me, along with a couple of other select ingredients. All you have to do is buy the perishable items. And then I'll sort of walk you through it step by step. My favorite recipe, my signature chicken curry, which is one of my mom's recipes. And also, you know, like a full menu of a dessert and a cocktail and a vegetarian vegan substitution for those people who don't eat meat. But we'll make the food together, you know, have a drink, listen to some Bollywood music, watch some Bollywood film clips. And then in the course of it all, I'll also be telling a story about my family's immigrant experience. So it really is a piece of theater. It is a play, but there's cooking and food involved in it. So I kind of call it culinary theater, which is a phrase that I just made up. I don't know if that is actually a term, but it seems to describe what we're doing pretty well.
So were you an actor before all this?
Never. I was never an actor. I was never supposed to be. But when the Geffen called me in June, you know, about 6 months ago, and said that they would love to produce this show for me to be in, it sounded like such a strange, unexpected experience. And 2020 was such a strange, unexpected year as it was, that I just decided to go for it and jump at the opportunity. Now I'm freaking out a little bit, to be honest with you, because, you know, it's a full one-man show. I have to memorize my lines, and I have to learn my blocking, and I have to learn how to talk into the camera and all of these things, which have been a really fun and overwhelming experience for me.
The thing that I have to tell you about all that is that the food will ground you.
Yeah, that's what I really feel, is that I'll be cooking the whole way through, and it's my own kitchen, right? So I couldn't be more comfortable. And as those of us who are home cooks and chefs know, that we find so much comfort and, like you said, grounding when we are cooking for others. And I haven't had an opportunity to do that in such a long time because of the strange circumstances that we're in. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I'll be able to interact with people while the evening goes on. And so that part is going to be really special too.
Well, thank you so much, Sri. It's always a joy to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for your support of Bollywood Kitchen through the years. It really means a lot to me. I appreciate it.
That's Sri Rao. He has adapted his book, Bollywood Kitchen, for the stage. Visit geffenplayhouse.org to cook along through March 6th. Coming up, Black, White, and the Gray. In their new book, a Black chef and a white entrepreneur tackle big conversations about race and reconciliation in a historic southern town. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. A Black chef from Queens and a white business entrepreneur walk into an abandoned Greyhound bus station. The setup has endless possibilities, but for Mashama Bailey and John Omorosano, there was only intention. The Gray, their award-winning destination restaurant in Savannah, Georgia, provides more than meals to a community with a dark history of segregation. Their business partnership evolved into a friendship that serves as an example of the ability of a divided past to reconcile itself to a promising future. But like most good things, it takes work. Hi, you two. Welcome to Good Food.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having us.
Your book, The Black, White, and the Gray, is extremely unique. It's set up like a conversation. Each voice is in a different font. And so as a reader, one can clearly see at the same time dealing with similar events, how differently each of you was thinking about certain situations, which is just fascinating. Mashama, would you talk about your reaction when you read the first draft that Jono had been working on and how you felt?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So Jono had been working on the book for a little bit before I came on board. Initially, he was going to write, you know, the manuscript and sell it. And the book was just going to be a restaurant book about, you know, the gray, about building business or, you know, from Jono's perspective. And then once I signed on to the project, I sort of waited for him to finish the book almost in its entirety before I began to read it. And when I read it, I thought the premise was different. I didn't realize that I didn't understand exactly what I was walking into. I didn't have a full picture of what the book was going to be about. And so it starts off with this tragic event, which for me was still very raw. Our general manager at the time and I were involved in a tragic car accident, and we were together during this event. And after this event, I called Jono, and that's how the book opens. And so my reactions, I felt, were very, I just didn't know how to write and how to express those things. And I think the easiest way for me to say it is that I felt defensive. Maybe it was sort of like some defense mechanism laced with a little bit of frustration, laced with a little bit of anger or aggravation. So all these kind of emotions were sort of bubbling up while I was kind of reading this initial manuscript that I was going to write alongside of. So a lot of my reactions to it were very sort of like short and dismissive. And then I think we realized that that wasn't going to fly.
What's fascinating about it, reading it, is I feel almost like the conversation is this meta conversation of dealing with feelings that you had as a Black woman reading a story told by a white man about your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So much of what's revealed in this is the normal anxiety of what happens when two people go into business together with an overlay of you and him, the Black and the white. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think if you had two white males going into business together, you know, I think it's easier to, I think there's more of a baseline, right? They get the same jokes kind of thing, you know? And I think when you have two people so different who've grown up in such different communities, they're different races, they've grown up in such different communities, I think that there are these underlined things that they don't know about each other.
Jono, once Mashama really started digging into her part of the conversation, did you realize that this dance that the two of you were involved in on the page was almost like therapy?
It wasn't almost like therapy for me. I mean, therapy is not something I've ever done. And I now know what it feels like, though, right? Exploring your fears and your weaknesses and shortcomings and all of that and things that, you know, and your baggage, right? Your baggage from childhood. That is not something, you know, I've ever really done. Well, I mean, I guess I do it to myself, but I never did it with another person. And so when Mashama talks about the evening, you know, of her and Scott having, you know, this terrible thing happen, like that was a turning point, because it made me start to think about my relationship to race, and doing that with this Black woman that I admire as much as I admire anybody on the planet, like having her sort of sit down with me and us then get in this conversation about both of our sort of relationships to race. We had never talked about it out loud, even though we spent every day together. And so when she read the manuscript and now we're going to have this conversation about race and gender and and class and culture and all those things. It's like, that was a lot to bite off. And we decided that if this book is going to be our book, we have to actually go sit and write together and have the conversation in real time. And so that's what we did. So the whole thing was so cathartic. As Misham always puts it, as our relationship was not prepared to write this book. At the end of the book, we both feel more prepared than we ever did going into it.
I said to Jono, we were in Paris and we were probably like halfway through the first rewrite, or maybe a little bit more than halfway. And we were on a difficult part, you know, of the book. There are a few difficult parts of the book. And I blamed it on him. I said, you wrote a book that our relationship wasn't ready for, you know? It's like, well, let's talk about race. Why not talk about race? Why can't we just talk about it? Shouldn't we talk about it? And it's like, it's so layered, you know? And it's so personal. It's a very personal book. You know, it's our real feelings in real time, us sort of hashing them out in the middle of growing a business, in the middle of running a restaurant. So, you know, it gets hot.
And it's also, you're running a restaurant in a space that itself is extremely layered and filled with meaning. You end up buying this building, which is a Jim Crow era Greyhound bus station that still had all of its original layout, the colored bathrooms, the white ladies' room. Mashama, talk to us a bit about what it was like when you first walked into that space.
Well, the building is what got me down to Savannah, honestly. Like, I was sort of in this meeting with Jono, and we were getting along. It was our first meeting, and it went from an hour meeting to we had scheduled to meet for an hour, and it ended up turning into a four-hour meeting with, you know, wine and cocktails toward the end of it. So we had a great first introduction. And in that meeting, he showed me the blueprints of the space. And he pointed to the different parts of the space, and he pointed to the colored waiting room. And, you know, he said, well, you know, this is the colored waiting room. And I you know, wanted to back up to that point because I was fascinated by the fact that it was still in its own, it was still sort of like in its original state. And that was kind of like the match that was lit under me that wanted to sort of take this to the next step, because I thought that that was really interesting. But frankly, looking at these blueprints, I was like, I don't know if I can do this. I am working as a sous chef in a 34-seat restaurant. I don't know if this place is huge. And so I went down in January, and we walked into the space. And even though it was freezing outside, for Savannah, it was freezing, it immediately felt warm to me. It immediately felt like there was a lot of happiness that was shared in this space. And it just captivated me. And so I sort of took a tour around. And when I was standing in the original space of what was the colored waiting room, I just kind of knew that I could do it. I just kind of instantly knew that I could take this on.
Thank you so much, the two of you. It's such a fascinating book on so many levels, and I can't wait to go to Savannah and have a meal with you.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Evan, and we look forward to your trip to Savannah and you being our guest at the Grey.
That's Mashama Bailey and Jono Morisano. Together, they are the Grey and have documented their friendship and their restaurant concept in their new book, Black, White, and the Grey. During the 17th and 18th centuries, tea was what a limited edition sneaker drop or Perigord black truffles is today, writes Charlene Wong de Chen. In Beijing, when she encountered tea repackaged under a French label, Charlene began to question how European importers created a market to lure tea drinkers away from an originating and superior Asian market. Her piece for Whetstone Magazine traces this tea situation back to colonialism and its lingering problems of racial, class, gender, and labor hierarchies. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, Evan.
Why don't we have you give us kind of tea 101? What part of the world is tea indigenous to?
Well, tea is indigenous, the plant is indigenous to a part of Asia that overlaps present day Myanmar, Thailand, India, and China. I would say that most people agree that the kind of origin of world tea culture can be traced to Chinese tea production and Chinese tea culture. Those are the first written records about tea cultivation and tea consumption are found in Chinese written records. And they were sort of the source of what then later became Japanese, Korean tea cultures.
And when do these records show that tea started to be consumed?
I think the earliest tea cultivation and tea consumption records are from the Han Dynasty, which is 206 BCE to 220 CE.
You write, drinking a cup of tea grown in Asia or East Africa, somewhere in North America or Europe, is sipping a tangible vestige of colonial empires and trade routes. When do European records start to record these encounters with tea?
Well, the first written record, I believe, is the Dutch East India Company brought tea to Europe from Japan and China in 1610. So that's a long time between when the tea culture was flourishing in Asia and there was trade within Asian entities before there was any European contact.
And then once Europeans come in, of course, they can't get plants or seeds, so they have to trade to get tea. Talk about that trade a bit.
Well, in the beginning, China was interested in silver, and the British East India Company, and I think the Dutch East India Company to a degree, were able to trade tea for silver. It was a trade that was interchange of sugar, enslaved people, cotton, silver, and opium. These were all commodities that were being circulated to facilitate the export of tea from Asia to Europe.
So let's talk about this idea of tea needing to be decolonized. It's such a complex history, and you have a Western consumer going to a shelf and looking at tea. What should we be looking for, or what should we be aware of as we ponder the choice of tea?
There's a lot. I mean, I think the important thing to say about the decolonizing tea idea is I feel like that term is being used a lot lately in many different contexts. But in this specific context, I'm talking about a very literal colonial history, as we were just discussing. It's about a very specific history of colonial trade and exploitation that still has vestiges today. You know, many of the tea plantations, and the word plantation itself is a colonial instrument, right? That is not a coincidence. The plantations that were set up by the British in India and Sri Lanka and later in East Africa were modeled after the same plantations that were used in the New World in the cotton trade and in the sugar trade. So those are, I mean, that itself, right? Just the name of the site of production is a colonial vestige. But it's not just that. It's the way that these plantations are still set up are still on colonial labor structures. I mean, just how people are remunerated, what is expected, how labor is recruited. I mean, all of it. It's still, it doesn't look that different, in fact, than the 19th century today. But when the consumer is looking on a shelf for tea, what should they think about? I mean, you can't think of all of world history and all the politics and military inequalities in like one moment at each transaction you're having in a market, right? I mean, that's, it's impossible. So on one hand, you have to think like, what is it I want to drink and why? But I think it's important to think about the tea as a plant and as not just a flattened commodity. I think that's another vestige of the colonial history, is that tea was traded as a commodity to suit colonial markets. But in fact, tea is a living plant. A well-crafted artisanal tea requires an incredible amount of labor, from the farmers to the growers and the people who are picking the tea, and then the people who are taking a freshly picked leaf and transforming it into a fine dried tea leaf that you can then infuse with water. It's a lot of expertise, literal hands-on labor. And I think when you think about that, as you're looking at tea and what to buy it and how to buy it, maybe that would make prices in context feel different. If you think about all the labor that's required to actually grow tea and to then bring this leaf from halfway across the world to wherever it is you're buying it.
So we're in this moment now where a lot of us have just been isolated, or our lives have been limited in a way that they never have been before. And a lot of people are turning to different kinds of rituals. We hear so much about how people are drinking wine like they never did before. But tea has a very particular kind of ritual. And it seems that we in the West are starved for ritual and maybe are beginning to gravitate to tea to start to bring ritual into their lives. Can you share with us some of the early experiences that you had with tea ceremony that ended up informing this passion of yours?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you, Evan. I feel like I've had so many conversations with people about how starved they are for ritual and how interested they are in creating some sort of tea ritual, or this idea of ceremony and ritual that everyone feels bereft of, and they're turning to tea as sort of a spiritual pathway. You know, for me, even though I'm Chinese American and my family's, you know, many generations ago are from tea growing areas of China, I didn't really grow up in a household where tea was in any way special or ritualized, or there was any sort of ceremony. I mean, my main memory of tea is it in like little ceramic cups spinning around on a Lazy Susan at a very loud dim sum restaurant in Southern California, or, you know, in an electric kettle samovar in the fellowship hall of our Chinese Baptist church in Anaheim. I mean, it's not, and it was always like a background thing. But the first time that I experienced any sort of, you know, kind of ceremonial feeling around tea was actually going to a British high tea in Canada, which is kind of funny because that was incredibly colonial in itself. I mean, it was in a hotel called the Empress in a city called Victoria. I mean, there's like nothing that could be more imperial and colonial in its setting. And, you know, my mom grew up in Hong Kong, which, when she was growing up in Hong Kong, she was a British colonial subject. It was a colony. It wasn't a post-colony. It was a colony. And, you know, so she grew up informed by British colonial values. You know, she was eager to introduce a British high tea to us, her family, as a fun cultural activity. And it was fun for all of us, you know, but it wasn't until much later in life that I was like, huh. I mean, British tea culture, right, is an extension of the British East India Company's trade of tea. And the British East India Company's trade of tea was so profitable that it, in fact, created that. I mean, that was like the engine that fueled its expansion of empire. That's how they got their cash. And to further that, like, you know, the Opium Wars, which the British fought with China, was not really about opium, it was about tea. They wanted more access to more tea. And so they were smuggling opium into China so that they could get more silver, so that they could buy more tea.
And in fact, during the Industrial Revolution, it was used for the working classes and sold to the working classes almost as a drug, this
yeah.
very strong, low-quality tea, highly sweetened right. and served with milk. So tons right. of it could be drunk to fuel staying awake so you could work in these factories.
Right. But, you know, the interesting thing about that, Evan, is when tea first went to Japan, the monk that's credited for bringing it to Japan is because he went to China to study an esoteric form of Buddhism. And he learned about tea because the monks there were drinking tea to stay up to meditate. So they were using it in the same way that these industrial capitalist owners were using it to keep their workers awake. It was also used as a way to keep monks awake for spiritual enlightenment.
I love food. It's such a lens.
I know. There's just so much.
So much. Thank you so much, Charlene. Take care.
Thank you.
That's food writer Charlene Wong DeChen. Read her story for Whetstone on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we trace the histories of LA's birria obsession from Tijuana to Los Angeles to Canada. That's in 1 minute when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Over the past few years, I've become used to a familiar image on my Instagram feed. It's a red, soupy stew of beef tucked into a corn tortilla stained red from the juices. Birria de Res has become a bona fide phenomenon, and Bill Esparza documented the taco's epic journey from Tijuana to Los Angeles and beyond in a deep dive for Eater. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Evan. How are you?
I'm good. Reading this story that you did for Eater really makes me want to go back to Tijuana with you, though. I can't wait till we can travel
again.
Let's do it.
That was a pretty fun trip.
It was a pretty fun trip. So what is birria?
Well, birria is a stew. And the most famous version is, of course, goat from Jalisco. But in Jalisco, they do birria everything. They do beef there. They also do lamb. It's their state dish. So birria ends up all over the place. I actually once went to a roadside place in Jalisco that was an ostrich restaurant, and it had ostrich birria. So there you go. You know, it's an adobo. The meat is rubbed in an adobo, and that's used to make the soup. Traditionally, it's you know, close to the barbacoa tradition. It was done underground. Today, it's done in ovens and in various types of ovens. It's steamed. And of course, in Tijuana, it's cooked in a big pot, like a soup or a stew.
So I understand that the taqueros in Tijuana who are known for making this type of birria in a pot are mostly from Puebla. Did these cooks bring that tradition with them from Puebla?
No, they didn't bring it to. It's funny because, I mean, the story is interesting because it's taqueros from Puebla who developed the dish there. And of course, there were all kinds of influences. The Jalisco influence is always there. It's birria. But there was also Mexico City. And there was also the local demand. People in Tijuana don't like goat so much. They like beef. You know, they're steak eaters. And then, you know, it developed more into a soup. And that's just become the standard, the way you get it in Tijuana. You get it from a pot. And you'll get it in a cup where they call birria en caldo. Or you'll get it in a taco. And then they wet the tortilla with the sauce. So the red thing really started in Tijuana, and people just love it.
You know, what fascinates me about this story, like so many food stories, is all of the, like, the family trees and
yeah.
how one guy will start it, he'll take it somewhere, he'll start making bank, bringing something to the market that wasn't there before, doing it better than anybody else. And then somebody sees him and says, well, I can do that. Let me do that somewhere else. So tell us a little bit about Teddy Vasquez and Omar and Oscar Gonzalez, who they are and how they fit into this sort of family tree of birria.
Well, first of all, they're both from the town, the most famous town of these taqueros is Coatzingo, Puebla. So their family's from there. And of course, you know, like all Mexican families, we, you know, during Semana Santa, we go back to see our relatives and spend time with family. So, and there's big fairs. It's fun. So Teddy Vasquez, his family's from Coatzingo, and so is the family of the Gonzalez brothers and sisters that own Birreria Gonzalez. And the Omar Gonzalez and Teddy met at the fair or hanging out during Semana Santa and became friends and kept touch. But at that time, they weren't, you know, they weren't interested in birria. They were just kids. And they sort of happened into the birria world, not really by their own ambitions, but it just kind of landed in their lap. And what's really amazing is birria is something more popular in the Mexican community. But these guys, these two businesses, they've made it like popular across the board. I mean, really mainstream here in the United States.
So Teddy is from Teddy's Red Tacos.
Teddy's Red Tacos. Yeah.
One of the things that fascinates me about these guys is the Nordstrom's connection.
The Gonzalez brothers.
Yeah. Talk about that connection and how Nordstrom's actually like has something to do with their success.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it was really funny talking to them because they were so like pro Nordstrom's. It was almost like a commercial, for, you know, when I was doing my interview with them, and several of the brothers were working there, and, you know, they had become successful as part of the Nordstrom's team. And they said that everything that they learned about business, about how they marketed. So if you look at Birreria Gonzalez, which was the first truck, like the way they do their design of their, everyone's copying that same design. And so everything about marketing, the presentation, customer service, and even the idea of like, it's LA and you just can't follow that tradition of just offering a meat and that's it. You know, so many businesses in Mexico are like, I'm going to make a pot of something and I'm going to sell until that pot runs out. And I'm never in my life going to add another menu item. And I'm never going to add a second pot. You know, it's kind of crazy when you think about it from a business standpoint, like, well, why don't you make a second pot? And the guy's like, well, because I can go home at 1 o'clock, you know, but their idea was like, let's expand the menu. We're going to have one meat. We're going to have birria, but we're going to make tortas and we're going to make quesavirrias because everybody likes cheese in LA and they're going to do.
Describe what that is.
Quesavirria is really just a quesadilla, sometimes called a quesataco, and it's where melted cheese is inside the taco, and you have melted cheese and birria. You know, for the keto people, you can do a chicharrón de queso and make a shell with the cheese, and sometimes that's also part of the, you know, tortilla. That's something that also they were doing in Tijuana starting in the 80s with tacos arrón, but it wasn't as big as it's become here in the United States. And now back in Tijuana, everyone's starting to change their menus and add more things because of, you know, it's all over social media and the whole dunking thing that started here with Birreria Gonzalez and Teddy's Red Tacos. And now like people are doing that in Mexico, you know, they're dunking their tacos in consomme LA style.
Yeah. I love that. I love how in Tijuana, the consumption of certain products are within pretty rigid boundaries. Like it's only for the weekend and you don't add this to it and it's served in this particular way. But of course, when things come up here, it's, you know,
yeah,
more creativity happens and then it like travels back home and changes the home.
When it comes to birria de res, Tijuana style, you're absolutely right. But Baja California has been one of the states that has been that has the least traditions in Mexico. In Puebla, you know, they're very, you know, back in Puebla, they're very strict about the foods and they don't change they don't evolve in the same way and such a radical way. But for some reason, all these here you got these poblanos coming to Tijuana and they're creating a tradition that just started recently, but they're pissed about the guys in LA changing the menu and like Teddy's Red Tacos putting purple onions. Like they're like, you can't put purple onions. We use white onions. Like, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, you guys are from Puebla. You're not even from Tijuana. You know, what are you getting mad at the LA people? But Teddy just laughs. You know, he's like, man, because they hate me down there. They're like always talking, yelling at me for all these changes I'm doing. But you know, the Nordstrom principle, you know, you got to offer the customer what they want. And LA people, they want cheese and they want, you know, molitas and they want tortas and they want different menu items. They don't just want to eat 10 tacos like they do in Tijuana, you know? And the other thing that's crazy is birria at night. I mean, all the birrerias in Tijuana, more or less, are closed by 1 o'clock noon, you know? In LA, like, they're doing birria at night. That's like the most radical thing ever.
So interesting. Everything is context. Everything is point of view. So where are Teddy's Red Tacos and where is Birria Gonzalez? Because after listening to this, people will want to know.
The original Teddy's Red Tacos is there on Slauson, but he's got like 4 locations. He's got an East LA. He's on the West Side. Birria Gonzalez, they have 8 locations, 7 or 8. Just about anywhere in Los Angeles, you know, you're in striking distance. And of course, all the disciples of them, all the different trucks that have followed. There's 1 million trucks out there now doing birria de res, estilo Tijuana. And now it's in New York and San Francisco and Chicago and Texas. And, you know, it's everywhere. It's in Canada, you know. And in the end, it's when it comes to selling tacos, it's good to work at Nordstrom.
Thank you so much, Bill. This has been really fun. And what a great article.
Thanks for having me on again, Evan.
That was Bill Esparza, food writer and author of El Mexicano. We've been talking about the piece he wrote on LA's birria phenomenon for Eater. And now let's head to the farmer's market, where Jillian Ferguson is catching up with one of LA's birria specialists, who recently expanded his repertoire beyond beef.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I am at the Santa Monica Farmers Market again this week. Today, we're here with Chef Carlos Aquez, who is pretty well known for the birria he sells at Birria Palacruda. And he has a brand new vegetable-focused pop-up called Ome Los Angeles. Hi, Carlos.
Hi, good morning.
So tell us a little bit about the inspiration for Ome, this new project you have.
So the inspiration for Ome was sort of something that was born after this last year of the pandemic we're in, and sort of realizing and noticing that our diets really play into our health. And so I figured, you know, I'm serving this great product that's a taco that people trust and enjoy and love. Let me start serving vegetables that can complement that and that have similar flavors tied into sort of my roots and the style of food that I'm serving. But let's make it all organic and make it all super packed with nutrients, and people won't even know it. They're just going to just eat good food.
I love it. So Birria Palacruda right now is out of a truck. Is Ome, the food that you're serving at Ome, is it served right alongside it, or is it a separate concept?
It's pretty much served in the same truck. The idea for Ome, I announced it as like Birria Palacruda's alter ego. And so it's basically like the same quality and sort of pedestrian style of food, but with like a little bit of finesse and a little bit of technique behind it and just a lot of like flavor.
Well, your cart is loaded down today. You've got a lot of cauliflower. So let's talk through what you're going to do with all this cauliflower in your cart.
Yeah, so we've got 8 heads of cauliflower today, and we're serving it with date mole that has about 21 ingredients. Pickled cauliflower escabeche, sesame seeds, and torpedo onions. And we cure the cauliflower. We quarter it, and we cure the cauliflower for about 30 minutes.
Describe what you mean by cure it.
So, yeah, I know, it's curing vegetables. Like, what does that mean? Basically, for me, I'm taking, like, the confit technique, where you would salt and cure a piece of meat, basically salting a piece of meat for a period of time till reverse osmosis goes into play and the salt sort of seeps into the protein. Sort of the same idea with the vegetable. So we're salting the vegetable with a salt rub that's kosher salt, bay leaf, oregano, black pepper, and a few other spices. And we're letting it sit for about 30 minutes. And it sort of brings out some of the moisture from the cauliflower and also penetrates that salt and flavor deep into the food. And then we slowly confit it in canola oil with bay leaf and chilies for about 30 minutes, and then pull it out and then let it cool. And then we sear that on the plancha to order.
Oh,
and then it gets topped with the mole and then garnished with the sesame seeds and the pickled cauliflower florets.
Wow. You also have your dates here on top of the cart as well. 21 ingredients. Are you making that once a week or is this yes. something?
Yeah, the mole is made once a week. We always save a little bit of the previous mole as like the mole madre or like the mother mole. And that goes fortified into the new batch. But yeah, we make it fresh every week. I make it fresh every week. It's to name a couple of ingredients, it has like pasilla, chili California, onion, garlic, tomato, dates, raisins, pepitas, almonds, sesame seeds, clove, allspice, chocolate, cinnamon. That's a few.
Wow, that sounds incredible. Well, this dish and your whole menu sounds so unique and delicious. It's great to meet you. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you for reaching out.
That was Carlos Saquez of Birria Palacruda and what he called his alter ego, Ome Los Angeles. You can find him on Instagram. Check it out, Ome, O-M-E dot Los Angeles. He's serving food Saturday and Sunday in El Sereno. One of the farmers who brings cauliflower to the market this time of year is Zach Nichols of Two Peas in a Pod up in San Luis Obispo. And Zach, you have, as always, your purple cauliflower, your white cauliflower, your orange cauliflower. Tell us a little bit about these different varieties that you grow and what the season is like.
So we have three different cauliflowers that we grow. We also do grow Romanesco, which is Italian cauliflower. We have the cheddar, which is the orange, the purple, which is called graffiti, and then the white, which is actually the variety name is Candid Charm. The winter is a perfect time to grow cauliflower due to the family that it's in. Cruciferous is what the name is. The reason why the winter is so perfect for it is because they need chilling hours, cold hours. For example, yesterday we got to the farm at 8 in the morning. And it was 26 degrees outside, so everything was super frosted. When a cold event happens, the plant stresses, and it releases a chemical called anthocyanin. That is like the little purple that you see if like there's a, on the white cauliflower, it's like speckled with purple. Also, when you look at the purple cauliflower, the reason why it is purple is because it's full of anthocyanin. So not only do they give it like a purple hue that's beautiful, most importantly, they give it flavor. So it's sweetness. On top of the sweetness, health, antioxidants. Anthocyanin is one of the main components of antioxidants.
Now tell us exactly what it is we're eating when we're eating cauliflower. Is it actually the flower of the plant?
So it's actually a premature flower. What you're eating is what the flower will actually become. It's kind of cool. As for example, today we have broccolini flowers. So all the florets and everything you eat in the cruciferous family will soon be flowering. And it's also used as a garnish on a lot of restaurant plates. The flowers that do come out of it are really, really sweet. They're all different colors. The purple one has yellow flowers. The white one has white flowers. Broccolini has yellow. So it kind of goes every way. And then as they get older, the cool thing is they do get sweeter.
All right, Zach. Well, as always, you are full of fascinating information. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
That was Zach Nichols of Two Peas in a Pod. You can find them at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market and also on Sunday in Hollywood. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
This week's In the Weeds is coming up next. Stay close. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. When Monica May and Kristen Trattner opened Nickel Diner in downtown LA back in 2008, the neighborhood looked different than it does today. Known for her Pop-Tarts, homemade ding-dongs, and hangover helper, Monica's food is a familiar hug, and who doesn't need one of those right about now? She joins us for this week's installment of In the Weeds.
Hi, my name is Monica May, and I'm the chef and co-owner, along with my partner, Kristen Trattner, of the Nickel Diner in downtown. The Nickel Diner is a restored 1940s diner that we unearthed when we did the construction and found old menus on the wall that sell 25-cent hamburgers and 15-cent baked beans and hot dogs. And it's a It's a community place. It was built for our community, by our community. We opened in 2008 at the height of the last recession, when nobody was giving money to women, much less two women opening a diner on Skid Row. And our neighborhood banded together and saw the need and ultimately helped us with funding. And as a result, we've fed everybody here. I mean, downtown has always been this incredible, eclectic mix of people. And it was very important to us when we opened that we were always inclusive as opposed to exclusive. And as our neighborhood has grown and changed, that still continues to be so today. You know, there was quite a boom for a while, and rents went up and rates went up, and everybody thought that this was going to be the new gold mine. And the pandemic really took a hit on the neighborhood, especially over the last 6 months or so, in June, when the protests and then the looting started in our neighborhood. I mean, we were really at ground zero and in the crosshairs of everything down here. We had the National Guard on every corner with guns drawn. Our neighborhood, the glass all around us was broken, and businesses were just really shattered. And then after that, they boarded up. So now we look like a complete and total ghost town. And the office buildings around here as well are closed up. People are working from home. So we've lost that energy as well. And now it's, the handful of people that are still living down here, and then the people who are on the streets who really don't have a choice to live anywhere else. One of the things that's interesting about where the Nickel is situated is that we are the only business on this block. We are situated between two low-income hotels and Chrysalis, which is a job placement center. So it really focuses on who is eating our food. And I mean, certainly there are the people who live in the lofts surrounding us, but our day-to-day folks are really low-income folks, and we see what they've been going through. And they've always struggled, and we've always fed the neighborhood. I mean, whether it's leftover biscuits on the weekends or giving our locals a special sort of like $5 discount on the menu, we have always participated in keeping an eye out. And certainly with regards to that, people have always kept an eye out for us. One of the great things that the Nickel has provided us is tons of great stories, the connections that we have to our customers and our community. And I have a really good one to tell you about Thanksgiving. So for Thanksgiving, we fed 1,000 people in the Skid Row hotels around us. And a couple of weeks ago, one of our neighbors who is a rascal, an older gentleman, came down in front of the restaurant in a panic because he couldn't get up to his hotel. He lives in one of the old buildings here where the elevators had broken, and he was upset. His animals were upstairs, his meds were upstairs. So we thought, okay, well, let's help you, right? So I grabbed two of our guys, we grab a chair, we're gonna get him up the stairs, and we go into the lobby of this hotel, and there is this line that's like the ascent to Everest, climbing the stairs of all of these people who are trying to get up to their rooms, and they're having difficulty, and it's arduous, and we're trying to help our friend. And we noticed that the gentleman in front of us, who is this, rather large, huffing and puffing gentleman, has cut his hand. And I'm like, oh God, all right, you know what? We have a first aid kit. People cut themselves all the time. We're gonna run back. And I grab the first aid kit and a couple of Cokes, because the guy we're trying to get up is a diabetic, and I know he's gonna need some help. So we make the ascent up, and I said to the gentleman who's cut his hand, I'm like, here, let me fix this. And he looks at me and he goes, oh, he goes, you're the Nickel Diner. He goes, that Thanksgiving meal that you provided was so good. He goes, it reminded me of my sister's food, but you know what? She used to deep fry her turkey. And we ended up sitting on a stoop. I bandaged his hand, we cracked open the Cokes, and he told me about how his sister made Thanksgiving. And that's the connection. I mean, that's what's great about food, is that it's the ultimate unifier, and it allows you to see the humanity around you and to connect. And you connect with people that you would never think that you had something in common with, but there it was. one of the things that we've done to support ourselves, initially we started off with a Dine 1-1, which is a nonprofit group that was formed to help healthcare workers and restaurants to feed them. And we've made connections through them. We started feeding the John Wesley Healthcare Center down on Skid Row and looked at what they needed and thought, wow, how do we parlay this into some sort of subsidy for ourselves that keeps our restaurant together, keeps my employees together, and helps all these folks? I mean, you know, you go down to Skid Row and it's, you know, it's like an ant farm. There's just so many people in need. So the Pay It Forward meal program that we are doing here at the Nickel Diner is a program designed where you can purchase a meal and basically pay it forward to someone who is in need. We are gathering funds so that we can feed our various groups down here. And when we got involved with the Regarding Her Festival, our friend Gannett from Meals from Gannett got involved and wanted to work with us, but she said, you know, I'm too busy, I've got too much stuff going on. So she started the ball rolling with a donation, and that donation has snowballed and allowed us to continue what we hope for the next couple of months will be, if not once, but potentially twice a week now, feeding the neighborhood. Ultimately, that's how we're surviving. We've turned ourselves into a soup kitchen. So every week we're doing upwards of 250 to 300 meals for the community. And then on the weekends, doing brunch for the rest of the community.
That was Chef Monica May of Nickel Diner. Together with Kristen Trattner, she owns Nickel Diner in downtown Los Angeles. Today is the final day to contribute to the Pay It Forward program through the Regarding Her Food Festival. And you can always support them by ordering weekend brunch at nickeldiner.com. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks go out to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Messiha, and PJ Shahamat. I'm Evan Kleiman. Stay safe, stay hungry, and you know what I'm going to say, don't forget to tip. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.